This podcast is sponsored by Rode Microphones, the choice of today's creative generation. Small HD, real-time confidence for creatives. Hey everybody, this is Charles Hain here for the No Film School podcast for the week of January 27th, 2020. I am here doing the second writer staff roundtable of Sundance 2020. I am here with, to my left,
Oakley Anderson Moore,
George Edelman,
dishwashers between me and George, and this is Ryan Koo, founder of No Film School.
Dishwashers' posts have not been tracking as well lately, so I don't know if Dishwasher's going to keep writing with us in the future, but we wanted him on the staff podcast just in case. So you'll hear from Dishwasher from time to time.
Pretty frequently, apparently.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't ruin the podcast.
Mid-cycle, you cannot turn it off, so just stay for the beeps.
Yeah. Chiming in, huh? Sorry.
All right.
Stay for the puns.
We are now in the middle of Sunday, which means we're in the middle of, like, the first weekend of Sundance is wrapping up. For those of you who know a little bit about Sundance, the first weekend is sort of the monster weekend. Like, it is the big, like, many people come Friday to Monday, and so things are winding down, which is crazy because I have more party invites for tonight, Sunday night, than for last night by far, and for any other Sunday in my yearly schedule.
I think that this year may be a little bit different because I feel like more stuff is happening Sunday and Monday for the dishwasher than usual, right?
Yeah.
Like, there are more premieres on Sunday and Monday than in years past. So maybe they are trying to make an effort to spread it out more as opposed to just having everybody show up for this crazy mad weekend and then leave.
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, a lot of my film interviews are tomorrow and, you know, not spread out at all. I have 6 interviews with filmmakers tomorrow, which is exciting, but, you know, that's a lot. So are they trying to change Sundance so that it's not just all the beginning? Because you don't want to be a filmmaker who's so excited to premiere at Sundance and then find out you're premiering at the end of the week when everyone's gone.
Yeah.
You know, that sucks.
I've talked to a few directors and producers who are talking about how they have, I think part of the reason there's a scheduling split where something will come out first weekend and then another screening like a Thursday is to try and keep people like sticking around longer and less just like everyone comes Thursday, Friday, everybody's out Monday, you know, but
I guess for those of you listening, none of this matters.
Right.
Yeah. So let's talk about the things that we have seen and what has struck us and what we're sneaking with. All right, so far, what is the favorite thing people have seen?
Oh, wait, guys. Sorry. I have some breaking news. As of this week, No Film School is 10 years old.
Oh, whoa.
Wow. It's our anniversary, guys.
Happy birthday.
Wow. It's 10. Another one of those life moments where you're like, wow. Things are way older than I thought they were.
Yeah. 10 years is a long time in digital media.
Yeah.
Like,
we're still here.
Yeah.
Well, you're still here.
You guys are all still here. I'm not here with a bunch of spirits. You have not passed on.
Dang. So that means 10 years ago, I was reading No Film School for the first time, trying to figure out how to use my T2i DSLR.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Which I still have.
I was going to say, T2i, the whole DSLR, they still, you know?
Yeah, they're still nice images.
Age well.
Yes.
They do. I use them all the time with my film students. So
in fact, we have a great post on nofilmschool.com by a filmmaker who was talking about why he likes the imagery from the DSLR. He made his own feature by himself recently, and he has 2 posts up, actually. And one is about how he made a 3,000-shot feature just with him and his wife. And the other one is a follow-up where he dives a little deeper into how, but he talks about how great the DSLRs still are, and they're a lot cheaper.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Also, I think the aesthetic is coming back around. Like, I had a student recently who wants to do a mumblecore movie, and she's like, I really want to, like, nail that, like, 2005 to 2009, like, look of, like, the early Canon 7D HVX 200. And I'm like, oh my God.
That's a look?
Like, I was alive. I shot a feature on the HVX 200 in 2006, and now people are nostalgic for it.
Have you guys ever met anybody who loves the look of, like, a VHS tape?
Oh, yeah. I used to have a director like I shot a lot of VHS for. Yeah. Like, she would collect VHS cameras on eBay, and whichever ones worked, we'd shoot with, and it's a thing. People have affection.
It's really
for you
weird.
Kids listening, VHS was this thing.
It's really funny about VHS.
Kidding, cassettes.
You will hear, I think the kids are the ones who like it.
Oh, yeah.
Because you'll hear people talk about it the way we might talk about film stock.
Yeah.
And I'm always just like, what?
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, back to what might actually apply to people who are here. We've done a lot of roundtables so far. So we've talked to a ton of producers, editors, cinematographers, filmmakers already here, and people of the New Frontier program at Sundance. And those are all going to be on the podcast, so look out for those. But along with that, we've seen a ton of movies. I think we should go around and just talk about maybe one thing that's really stood out so far to everybody that educationally, that was like they thought, wow, that's really insightful, valuable thing that I've gotten or heard that I want to highlight.
Well, I think it's easy at Sundance. You know, you look around and there's the Acura Lounge and the Chase Sapphire Lounge, and there's all these really big corporate sponsors. And what you'll hear sometimes from the indie crowd is like, oh, Sundance has gotten corporate, you know, like it's not for independent film anymore. And there's two points I want to make about that. One is the less indie films that are here that are full of stars, those are the ones that get the corporate sponsors and that get the larger press to be here. And that's what pays for the indies to be here selling out shows. Like, you can't have a festival of this size with this kind of apparatus that has this kind of name recognition without the larger movies. So in light of that,
it's a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you've got to put something on the cover of the magazine, right? That gets the masses that appeals to the masses. And then you have your in-depth article on genocide on the, you know, in the middle of the
magazine. I want to footnote that later because I want Charles to talk about his narrative about charisma for Sundance 2020.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. We were also talking about a way that applies to publishing, but maybe we'll leave that off this podcast.
Yeah. The TLDR version of that. Charisma, good. So I just saw Beast, which is a movie from the production company Vanishing Angle, who also made Thunder Road, and we've covered on No Film School a lot. But it's the kind of movie that refutes the narrative around Sundance being too corporate, right? This is a film that is about guns in a small town. It stars nobody. It's a low-budget movie, and it's incredibly powerful. You know, and it's one of the movies that walks the line between sending a message without feeling like it's hitting you over the head, which is something that I had to deal with a lot on my own film, Amateur, and Beast is just, you know, it's about how unnecessary and infuriating gun violence is in this country. And it's incredibly relevant and it's powerful. And it's a small indie that hopefully with the aid of a platform like Sundance will be larger out in the world as a result. So that's my, you know, educational lesson or the thing that I learned or the thing that made me feel good, because Sundance, like any other festival, is very hit or miss. And if you came to Sundance and you saw two movies, you might say, well, I was disappointed in both of them, and why were they at Sundance, and therefore I don't like Sundance. It's just, you know, it's going to be all over the place. And so you've got to really go and see a bunch of movies and find the diamonds in the rough, and that was one of the great films I've seen so far.
Let's go to Charles.
Well, I also just want to riff on what Ryan was talking about, which is this interesting, like, this important observation to remember that it's an ecosystem. And so, like, I think it was The Intercept just had a big article on how the Washington Post survives. They have the prestige above the fold, and then below the fold, they have a whole bunch of clickbait that, like, nobody really pays attention to, but, like, that is how the Washington Post survives. Also being owned by a billionaire helps. But, like, for all of the things at Sundance where you're like, that doesn't feel very indie, or that's already, like, those things would bring in all that sponsorship and all that attention, direct attention to things like Beast, which I haven't seen yet, but was one of the things I'm most excited about and am most excited about, having read about it and now talking to Ryan, who's seen it. And
oh, by the way, Micah Van Hove, our own writer, has a piece coming on that on the website. Continue, Charles.
Yeah. So that's sort of the interesting challenge of all of this. I've already talked a lot about enjoying a couple things at New Frontier, which is another one of those things that, like, New Frontier exists at festivals. Tribeca has something similar with a similar name that, like,
don't, is its name New Horizon?
It might be New Horizon. Nobody goes to festivals for the VR lounge, or like four people go to festivals for the VR lounge. But like festivals with their attention and the Acura sponsorship. The Acura sponsorship comes up a lot because there's Acura. Like, what's their race car? The NRX, the NCX. You see them everywhere. Like, they're on the main street. Like, they're just driving around in these, like,
snow?
Yeah. I think they're four-wheel drive. I think that's the reason why Acura sponsors Sundance, because they have a four-wheel drive race car.
The Film School podcast brought to you by the Acura NSX.
NSX. NSX.
Is that the one Iron Man drives?
Yes, it is okay. The one Iron Man drives.
See, and I'm cool.
And that's how it relates to movies.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's been other things. I haven't actually seen anything. I didn't see anything yesterday that I would be like as passionate about as Ryan with Beast Beast. But everything I saw yesterday was interesting and challenging in its own way that I thought was really interesting. The thing I saw yesterday that's probably most relevant to our audience, because it's one of those real classic indie movie journey stories, is like Justin Simeon, who did Dear White People. Dear White People started as a Twitter account and turned into a movie and then turned into a TV show and is now pivoting out of the Dear White People universe, right?
Cinematic universe.
Cinematic universe. White people verse into he's now done his sort of follow-up movie. I think having a TV show totally counts as a follow-up to a feature film. It's probably way more lucrative than making feature films, but did Bad Hair. And Bad Hair, opening night of the festival premiere, it premiered Thursday night, saw it yesterday morning, and it is an interesting genre turn. And there's a lot of really interesting lessons in filmmakers in it. There is totally comedy. Like, he made his name in comedy. Comedy is what, like, launched him in Dear White People. But, like, it is a very aggressive move into genre. And it's one of those things that, you know, as a sophomore picture, you have a lot of choices. And there are a lot of filmmakers who are like, I'm going to make my sophomore picture, and it's going to be my freshman picture, but bigger. And this is a very deliberate choice to expand the palette. To go, it's a period piece. It's a period piece set in 1989. There's a lot of love for 1989 in the movie, in both the content of the movie, but also the aesthetics. Like, it feels very much like a movie that could have been made in 1989. I know there's some CGI, but they also really lean into practical effects. And I enjoyed it. I enjoy watching the journey of filmmakers as their careers evolve, as they make decisions. Like, when they have the luxury of decisions, a lot of people don't have, you know, as Sundance likes to talk about all the time, the biggest... So many people make one movie and never make another. Like, it's sometimes just as hard to get your second feature made as your first. But when you are in a position to get that second feature made, when your first feature broke out the way Dear White People did and then led to a TV show, sort of expanding your palette and going a different direction, there's comedy elements. I'm not going to say there's not comedy elements. There's definitely some really funny Lena Waithe moments, and there's some, like, really nice sort of grace notes. But it's nice to watch a filmmaker push themselves out of their comfort zone, and I have a lot of respect for that, and I enjoyed a lot of that yesterday.
Cool. Oakley?
So what I think is cool that I've seen, you know, we're talking about Sundance and the corporate schlock and all that, and yes, there's so many douchey people that come here for Sundance that have a lot of money, but I just, every time, it's so inspiring to just forget about those people and go and see the films, the true indies, because those are where people are doing risky things, and that's the one thing that you can really, like, hang on to Sundance for. They program films that take risks, films that, you know, nobody wants to fund because they're trying to do something new. And I have two really great examples of films that I've seen that are doing that. On the narrative side, there's a film I saw called Summertime. The director is Carlos Lopez Estrada. He's done, like, music videos for Billie Eilish, and he had Blindspotting, a feature, come out. You know, a really cool director. He's not exactly indie for that reason, but what he did is he got, like, 25 kids. Some in high school, they're all part, some like slightly out of high school. They're part of this like Get Lit spoken word group. And he took 25 different pieces from them and made a feature film with their spoken word, turned into this like whimsical journey through Los Angeles. And I'm just like, what a cool concept. Like, that's a cool model. It's so refreshing to think like that you could make a film in this way, just throwing all the rules out the window and taking these unusual voices and piecing them together, and then can actually work. So that's inspiring. And we did an interview with him. So we're going to put that up like a whole model, like how you can try this out for yourselves, because this is like a cool model, not just a copy paste, but like take this and run with it.
It's also the kind of film that a festival as a platform makes someone think is possible to make, right? Because if you were just to do that and put it out on YouTube, you're not like, this is going to get millions of views and go viral. I'm going to make money on it. Like, you need somebody to put a stamp of approval and to push it out there and to get the press activity around it. So that's a great example. And the other one is?
And the other one is, so just like looking over into the documentary world, talking about taking risks, I saw a film called Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. And holy cow, these guys just break every single rule you've ever heard about how to make documentary films. And it's like amazing. It's a bar in Las Vegas with all these like sort of tragic but sometimes funny drunks hanging out on the last day of this bar. You watch the whole film, you're like, good God, how did they get all this? And it turns out they sort of like, it's such a, they went out and found people from other bars and brought them into the best possible bar to shoot this in and kept them there for a day and filmed a quasi-narrative, but it's actually real. I don't know. It's completely bizarre, but stylistically amazing. And so tender and thoughtful and sad and just all the emotions. And you just can't even believe, like, why they did this or how they did this. And so, you know, that's my other example. That we're going to do an interview with the Ross brothers about it. And, like, you know, that you can do this. You don't even have to throw the label documentary, narrative, whatever. Like, you can do all these crazy things because people are doing them here and they're getting played.
George, before you go, I have another bit of exciting news. In addition to No Film School celebrating 10 years, I have also just turned off the dishwasher.
Oh, nice. You figured it out.
Congratulations.
From a tech lesson standpoint, this is one of those RTFM read the fucking manual things because it has in really small print. If you hold this one button, it will turn off. Because, you know, you wouldn't know. It's not intuitive. So good design was missing on this dishwasher, or perhaps intuitive usage was missing.
Who's
on my part.
Who's the manufacturer?
But no, let's go ahead and blame me. It's my fault. I take responsibility.
Well, all of us. Yeah, I was just going to say, so I feel like I got a lot out of this producer's roundtable. I did. I've been a producer. And I was excited to do this because these are producers who've of all variety. And we'll have that podcast up for everyone to listen to and the post on the website. But what was interesting to me about it was there's so many things. A producer is with a project longer in many cases, than a director or writer. They sometimes come in after there's a script, but sometimes they're there long after, you know, as delivery and festivals and everything in sales and all of that. And learning about the nuts and bolts A to Z of everything that goes into making something happen, from how they pick scripts, what they want in a filmmaker that they're going to work with. And these are the producers who have the track record of actually seeing things through to the end and getting them deals and getting them to audiences' eyes. And so it's very hard. Look, a lot of people out there can pick up a camera and shoot something and create something now, which is great. But the hardest thing to do is to cut through the noise because there's so much content. And so what I liked about talking to the producers and hearing their perspectives was, how do they help get projects off the ground? How do they help bring filmmakers through the whole process? And how do they help cut through the noise? And how do you find producers like this? There's a lot, I think, of value in all of that. And if you want to, there are ways to do this without them. And if you're going to do it without them, you have to learn what they're doing. Does that make sense? You have to figure out how to do the things that they do if you're not going to have someone like them on your team, or many people like them in some cases. And look, there were some projects that were totally like bootstrapped, represented at that table. There were also producers who had worked with first-time filmmakers who came to them with this idea that they'd already researched, a doc in some cases, or just a vision that was based on a short. I mean, there's so many different things represented there, and I just think it's extremely valuable to understand what it is they're doing, whether or not you can get them. That was my
one other thing to think about with producers is if you approach your movie with an outcome in mind, I want to be at Tribeca, I want to be at Sundance, or I want this to go viral, or I want to sell it for a lot of money, or maybe all of those goals. But, you know, if your producer's track record is also indicative of what relationships they have.
Yep.
So if they've made a movie that was at Sundance before, or if they've made 10 movies that have been at Sundance before, they're probably going to have a better in with the programming team to get your movie seen and to get it to the top of the pile than someone who hasn't. So when you're looking for a producer, part of their track record is, you know, have they played the festival before that you think this movie is appropriate for?
Do they know sales agents? Because you're going to need sales agents. Do they know, you know, all? Yes, all of that. That's absolutely true. And a lot of them talked about that very point, is if you're looking for producers, find producers with the resume and the track record that matches your goals. And a lot of them also talked about how when they start with a script or a pitch meeting, they approach it like, what is the end? Where can I take this? Where can it go? How far can I get it? Like, where can it land? And all these things are valuable to think about whether you have a producer or not, I think.
I feel like I should say that, but getting into Sundance, that should not be a goal, because it's not really a goal. That's like an ends to a means. You know, to quote my friend John Reese, who's always like telling us, drilled this into our brains at the IFP lab, like, you want to get into Sundance, but what's the goal there? Because if you don't, like so many people listening and like, you know, myself yet, you're like, oh shit, well, if that was my goal, then now I'm screwed. But what was your goal? Was your goal to make back money, pay your investors? Was your goal to like get a million people to see your film? Was your goal to launch your career? Was your goal to like change the world through some kind of activist message? So, you know,
I feel like it just like popped into my head was the meme of the, I guess I'll go kill myself. Like, didn't get to Sundance. Guess I'll go kill myself. Don't do that, please.
No. And it's like reach for the stars and you end up with the moon, right? Like, you don't have to go to Sundance. But I think one thing that's helpful to think about is there's a certain, even if it's not a particular festival, if you and your producers are on the same page about how this movie is going to be successful at the beginning, then when you're wrapping up an edit, you don't necessarily need to have the conversation of like, well, this isn't as commercial as we wanted it to be.
Yeah, totally.
Or, you know, it's like if you're on the same page from the beginning with what kind of film it is this going to be something that needs a festival, that will play a festival and that is existing outside of the industry, or is this something that's more commercial? Like, at the beginning, that can be helpful to make sure that everyone has the same goal in mind.
Personal anecdote. I had a producer on a feature I did who was like, it's a South By movie. We didn't get into South By. This producer had never had a feature at South By. So all of these things applied to that experience. Now, what happened in the movie? We still ended up making money. Like, it got distribution. It went to like a, you know, one of the screenings you do for sales agents, and then someone, all that stuff happens. But the point is, like, there should be a plan. There should be a plan after the plan. Like, there should be a backup plan, because a lot of things aren't going to get into Sundance. Most things aren't going to get into any of the big festivals. So what else can you do? And we also talked about that on the roundtable. And some of them didn't really have answers because they're not producers who deal with those projects. But some of them did. I mean, I think I know Charles has an experience that relates to this too. But like, there's so many ways you can get your film seen that don't involve festivals. I think what you can get out of festivals, and I'll come back to the roundtable thing, is you can interact with other people in this industry who understand all these avenues and have explored a lot of them and can give you a lot of insight. Plus, you can, of course, see the projects that are here and get a sense of what is getting in here and why.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing that follows up on what we were talking about on the Friday, the first podcast, of like, festivals have like a brand or a personality, but festival audiences also have a little bit of a brand or a personality, right? So like what George was commenting on a second ago, I directed a feature film. We made all of our money back. It was a great success. We're very happy. Well, we're really proud of the movie. It is a regional movie set in West Virginia about intergenerational, like someone taking care of their grandmother when she gets Alzheimer's. It is like not a Sundance movie. It is not, you know, like
not I watched a movie.
Yeah. Like we self-distributed through Tug and then VOD, and like, all over West Virginia, I went to screenings of that movie where 300 people sobbed through the movie because, like, it was their experience and it resonated with them in this deep way, in a way that, like, if we had shown it at a place like South By or Sundance, I don't know that the audience would necessarily, like, there isn't one movie audience. There's a billion movie audiences, and you want to find the people that connect with the work that you are doing, and festivals are a great way to do that if their audience is your audience.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so on the flip side, it's also completely legitimate to say, I just want to get into a big festival because you want to get into a big festival because it feels nice to feel some sense of external validation. You have no control over external validation, but it's fair to want that.
I interviewed a director yesterday who wrote and directed Black Bear, and you can find that content on the site on No Film School. But what was really fascinating in talking to him was he'd been to Sundance 3 or 4 times already. He'd done it as an actor in a project. He'd done it because his wife starred in a project and he was here with her. He did it once just for fun. And he was like, but this time I'm here with a feature. And I did not expect that to happen. And it's awesome. And it's like, and here comes Emily, I think.
Yeah. that sound. We're hot swapping lineups here.
Emily is coming in from a screen. Back from an interview.
Hello.
Welcome, Emily, to the No Film School podcast.
As Emily gets settled, I do want to say we're talking about festivals and getting in, the validation that comes with it, or the rejection. Depression that comes with not getting in. But every festival is different. And one of the things that as our crew here attends more and more festivals, we all sort of learn better about the particular identity of a film festival and what they're known for example. And with Sundance, the more movies you watch, the more it becomes clear, George has made this point, that there's a particular kind of movie that makes sense here. If your movie is engaging with social justice, gender identity, indigenous issues, politics, you know, anything that's very, very zeitgeisty, or as progressive, Sundance may be your festival. if you are making a movie that is incredibly well made but is a crime thriller, your movie's not going to Sundance. I mean, unless you have some star who's been in four movies, or, you know, there's always avenues, but like those are the kinds of issues that you should be aware of. And if they're not present in your movie, then maybe another festival makes more sense. But it's not just a matter of like my movie should play the quote unquote best festival. It's
yeah.
Like, one of the values of coming to Sundance is seeing what the identity is and whether your content is a match for that.
And before I want to go to Emily, but I want to just piggyback something onto that because I spoke with a programmer, Charlie Sextro. That interview is also available on the podcast and on nofilmschool.com. And we talked a lot about the idea of point of view and perspective and how important it is, Ryan, what you're talking about. But you can't fake that. It has to be your thing. Like, I think people really have to come from an honest place, and they really value your personal story you are passionate about, and it has to come through. I also spoke with Kickstarter's director of narrative film, and that interview is up on the website, about what projects Kickstarter gets involved in to help people meet their goals. And again, one of the things they're looking for is, does the passion and the reason to tell this story, Last Black Man in San Francisco from last year was one of their projects, which Emily can speak to, but that was a big breakout. And she was like, we just felt their story on the page, on the Kickstarter. And we knew it was a story that needed to be told and was relevant. So it has to be also really connected to you, and that has to be obvious.
Emily, you missed it, but I pointed out that No Film School is 10 years old as of this week. So congrats on our 10-year-old baby here that we're...
A decade.
That means it's about to be a teenager. So ready for some tantrums.
The hormones are raging.
I don't know what that means in the website world. Like,
awkward stage is coming up, right? It's more like awkward stage.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I hope we already went through that.
Strange design choices.
I just wanted to say the one place where I think you can get your crime thriller to premiere at Sundance is in the World Cinema Dramatic Competition.
Yeah.
That's the only one place.
or if your crime thriller is based on a documentary that previously showed at Sundance. Because George and I went to a movie last night that was a very enjoyable movie called Dream Horse. I'm interviewing the director on Monday. Enjoyable movie, solid movie, not a Sundance movie by any means.
Really? How so?
It's just like a very nice slice of life like movie, but like there is not a lot of darkness.
There's no Sundance edge. Hook to grab to. There's like I'll tell you this. I was sitting in the theater, and at moments I was like, I can't believe I'm sitting in a theater in Sundance in 2020 next to Charles Haine. I'm not in my parents' living room in 1996. Not because the movie feels dated in any way. The movie's great. Like, and it worked on me emotionally. It's just a part of a different part of the cinematic lexicon, so to speak. Yeah. Like, it's a part of a different kind of storytelling than I expect to see here, which is also kind of cool too. I mean, I don't need to see one kind of thing when I come to Sundance. But
there was a documentary called Dark Horse that showed at Sundance in 2014. So it makes sense that they're like, okay, this documentary that showed here gets turned into a feature film. So of course we want to show it here. It's part of the journey of Sundance projects. It's part of the thing.
I also really liked something we talked about, how it was very much Frank Capra.
Yes.
And you said, but it's Frank Capra with pizzazz.
Yeah. Well, because it's like
it
all
has
of
this
them,
modern,
you know, like, it's like modern filmmaking techniques and helicopters and gimbals and all of that stuff. But it's still like Frank Capra at heart.
It was like an
enjoyable Saturday night movie.
Totally,
it is definitely a movie. Like, if any of you are in college and you're going home for Christmas and you're like, "What am I going to watch with my parents?" It is like the perfect watching with your parents movie.
By Rode Microphones, the Australian pro audio powerhouse making incredible gear for podcasters, vloggers, filmmakers, and musicians. Rode is at the vanguard of innovation for audio solutions for podcasters, offering groundbreaking products like the Rodecaster Pro, the world's first fully integrated podcast production studio, and PodMic, the ultimate podcasting microphone. Find out more about how Rode can help you cut through the noise at rode.com/podcasting. That's rode.com/podcasting. This podcast was recorded using Rode microphones and technology. Founded by a group of independent filmmakers, Small HD has been innovating the on-camera and production monitor industry for an entire decade. It started by creating the first ever HD monitor that could sit on top of a DSLR. Today, its products include the 703 Bolt that has an integrated wireless receiver and a daylight viewable screen. Small HD is in the business of providing real-time confidence for creatives. With an extremely wide range of field monitors, Small HD prides itself on durability and usability. Whether it's paired with a mirrorless camera during a wedding or used for Video Village in Hollywood, Small HD has a monitor for every production. Powerful software tools, a unified user experience, and premium display quality help make Small HD monitors the industry standard. Stop wondering if you've nailed the shot. Start having more confidence at the camera with Small HD. On camera and production monitors starting at just $299. For more information about Small HD products, go to smallhd.com.
Let me ask you guys something. Do you think that the narrative around a film project is overstated in choosing what plays a festival and not? And I don't mean like looking at the movie objectively in terms of the storytelling and the craft, but instead what you were talking about where, well, there was a documentary version of this at the festival a few years ago. Because when I'm disappointed in a movie that I see at Sundance, I still always can see with the narrative of the project, whether the filmmaker had a film here before or you know, there were actors in it before. It's almost always the narrative around why this should be selected is clear, but it's almost like, but what about the objectivity about the meritocracy of it all?
Emily hasn't said much. And I feel like Emily knows the festival's little corners very well.
Well, I think it's really it dependent upon whether that person is a Sundance alum, because it's basically like a shoe-in for Sean Durkin's film The Nest and Ben Zaitlin's film Wendy, which took 7 years to make and like famously had a really fraught development process. So that film has a giant narrative around it. If anyone else had made that movie, who knows if it would have gotten in. So absolutely, you're right. But they have to be a Sundance alum.
Does it bother you? That's the question that I think he was asking. Or do you think it's too much, right? Is that
So Sundance is a discovery festival. It is about discovering new voices in American film. That is why Robert Redford started it. And that's what we're here for.
Who's Robert Redford? I feel like a lot of people here honestly don't know. But anyway, not at this table. I mean, in this city.
So I guess then the question becomes:
has he been in a Marvel movie?
Yes, he has.
If it's about new voices, are you excluding a new voice in favor of a second time or third time alumni voice, as it were?
Yes.
But they also want to prop up the voices that they've supported. You know, yeah. I don't know the answer to this. I've noticed they've weighted it.
Like it's something like 65 or 70% Sundance alum / celebrity driven fare. And then the rest, you know, the writer-director breakout film.
Do you think there's an algorithm or at least a data point at which they can say, like, we need to do X amount of heavy lifting, like Ryan was referencing earlier, through people who will appear on the front page of THR and Variety, stars, second-timers, third-timers, in order to support the new voices we want to support? That's the way I assume it goes, but I don't honestly know.
I also think that there's a certain amount to which, like, a person getting in once doesn't necessarily always launch their career. Like, Ben Zetlin definitely led to the Oscars and whatnot, but, like, is he in a place where he can just get any movie he wants made yet? No, probably not. Like, that is one where there still needs to be some lifting. If Sundance is really going to, like, help launch that career, like, my parents still don't know Ben Zetlin, right? Whereas someone like Justin Lin went through the Sundance Lab. We don't think of Justin Lin as a Sundance filmmaker, but Justin Lin's a Sundance filmmaker. Like,
yeah, there's also a lot of huge Hollywood filmmakers who came through Slamdance.
Yeah.
And to speak about, is it Ben Zetlin or Ben Zeitlin? Can someone correct me? Okay.
I don't know.
So Ben Zeitlin and I had shorts at a Florida film festival together in the same program way back when. And I remember seeing his short. It was very much a precursor to Beasts of the Southern Wild. And, you know, it was in the
Glory at Sea.
I don't know if that was the name. But yeah, I remember being in the shorts program and seeing the film and being like, interesting, very experimental, very like weird. And like, you know, people liked it and like very different than what I was doing at the time. And then later when I saw Beasts of the Southern Wild, I was like, wow, this reminds me of that short I saw. And then I was like, oh, it's the same guy. So point being, long story short, there's a lot of ways. Like he had a short at a little Florida film festival and then he made the feature. And then, you know, and to the question is, can he get any movie he made once in Hollywood? No.
Well, and that's
most people can't.
But like Justin Lin sort of can at this moment, right? And so like Sundance probably doesn't feel a big obligation to screen Justin Lin movies right now, because it's like that is a career that we've participated in the launching of that voice, which is like a voice that like I have a lot of affection for. Like few people can do action like Fast Five, which is one of my favorite movies of the last decade. And like I feel like Sundance, I feel like we have to acknowledge that letting you in more than once is sometimes necessary to really launch a new voice.
Totally.
That it's not, because there's a part of me that, like, you know, when I hear about Ivy Leagues and it's like, well, if your parents went, you're practically guaranteed admission, that makes me want to vomit. And so, like, when I hear, like, alumni guaranteed admission, it's like, part of me rejects, but it's like, no, it actually is, it sometimes it takes a couple run-throughs here to get someone's career actually going.
Yeah, and I would say that you count as an alum even if you've been through the Screenwriters Lab or similar.
I disagree.
Really?
We have an alum.
As someone who's in the Screenwriters Lab. Well, one of the things that, first of all, I want to say that 44 of the movies here at Sundance are first-time filmmakers, so it's not like they're not doing God's work, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's still a discovery festival, but I just mean the more you attend the festival, the more you sort of see.
That is in our infographic.
It's in our infographic. The Sundance Institute is the overall organization that Robert Redford started. The, what was it called originally? The U.S.
USA,
Film Festival?
Yeah.
American Film
The American Film Festival was the original film festival that is run by the Sundance Institute. And there is a separation of church and state. The movies that the Institute supports, you know, I think you have a chance of having your movie seen by the senior programmers at Sundance, certainly, but what they support is not necessarily going to play the festival. And I have friends who've, you know, been through the lab and didn't get into Sundance and then had success at other festivals. And, or in my case, you know, I made a Netflix movie. It was going to go straight to Netflix, not Sundance. And I don't even think Amateur was a Sundance movie, because exactly as we were talking about earlier with what kind of social justice issues you engage with, like my movie is ultimately a social justice movie, but it takes the side door and it's about athletes, and people are going to say, well, these guys make $10 million. So like, you know, where's the lack of justice for them? So I know a number of lab alumni who have not gotten into the festival, who then went on to play South by or Tribeca or you know, international festival like Berlin, for example. So there's supposed to be a separation of church and state, and in my experience, it is true. Now, you do see a lot of alumni here, but that's also kind of how Sundance is tracking movies from their inception. They're already on their radar. It's just another method that the programmers see. But I would take issue with the idea that if you are a lab-supported film, you get in, because I know many, many people
right.
who have not.
I wasn't saying that, but I was saying that of the new writer-directors that I was looking at, because I think about like a breakout film as a writer-director-driven project that's super low budget, because most of the time, you know, you can't get your movie made unless you also write it. And then those are the really, you know, the up-and-coming auteur visions. Those people seem to have all come from the Sundance Labs. So it's not like there seems to be a pipeline, even if it's not guaranteed entry. There's definitely a pipeline. And to me, there seems to be not a lot of room for someone coming out of complete left field as a writer-director.
Right, someone who goes to the Sundance.org website or through Film Freeway and submits it and doesn't have a connection. And that's, you know, that's something that
people... still waiting to hear if they got into this year's festival.
Are you speaking from experience? Or?
No. But I mean, everybody's like, "Do you think I got it?" I'm like, "You haven't heard back yet." Like
the press release is already out there. Yeah, you didn't.
I think
like, son, I'm sorry, but
yeah, I think that to be fair to the programmers, it's hard. There's so much stuff out there. So how do they know about stuff? Like you just said, tracking something.
15,000 submissions, according to our infographic.
Right,
but
so
I do want to say
one way
from
to
what
know,
I can tell, it all gets watched. Like, I know there's a lot of rumors out there that it's like, well, there's so much watch, but like, from what I can tell talking to programmers and talking to people, like, it does all get watched.
Yeah. Yes, and so, okay, here's the thing. We had an article on No Film School, it's one of the favorite ones we've run in the last few years, about a filmmaker who submitted to several festivals, used a unique Vimeo link for each one, so he could track whether his film was watched, and he was rejected by plenty of festivals where his unique link to them had zero plays. Sundance was not one of those festivals, by the way. What Sundance does is the senior programming staff of however many people it is, a dozen, I'm just guessing, I don't know, they can't watch 15,000 movies. So they have watchers watch them. And if you're one of the nice things about a big festival is they have corporate sponsors, which means they have a budget, which means they can employ multiple programmers to watch a submission. And so therefore, you're not necessarily at the behest of one person's opinion. You know, your submission might be watched by a few. So if one person didn't like it and the other two did, then it can make its way to the next round of programming. So, you know, good festivals, yes, they should watch everything. And then, yeah. But there are a lot of festivals out there that don't.
Well, I mean, there are little festivals that are just rackets.
Yeah, I think we should be honest. That's a real thing.
Yeah, that just want to.
We're not doing roundtables at those festivals.
We're not going to report on those festivals.
You know, I kind of wanted to bring up. We're just when we're talking about discovery, and you know, are the first time or second time filmmakers. You know, what's fair about the who's getting discovered? We're just looking at features. What are your guys' thoughts about the role that having a short at Sundance Place? Because I've had a shorts roundtable. We're doing another one, and like you know, I really like shorts at the festival. And there's some that are here this year that came as shorts, and you're just talking about Ben Zeitlin having a short. You know, what do you guys think about the role Sundance plays at the shorts level?
It's like
a different pipeline for sure.
Right. I think other Completely people different. At the table will speak to the Sundance part more specifically from both experience and inside knowledge. What I can say is that in the people I've been talking to and a lot of the interviews I've done, there is an increasing pipeline from shorts in general to bigger things. Like I think like Kickstarter, and it's also covered in this piece, they're doing like a shorts month in March. Like there's a lot of people looking to foster more short. Look, it's easier to watch shorts, right? So it's easier to identify something and then say like, okay, I want to see more. And like Indie Episodic program here at Sundance is another place where like you could have short content. It doesn't need to be any length or fit into any box necessarily, because the idea of that program is that it's reflecting, again, Charlie Sextro explains this a lot in our interview about it, but it's reflecting that the community, the creative community and audiences at large are really interested in streaming content, bingeable content, like YouTube content. Like so,
Quibi. Content, which leads us to the shushioning. We'll get to
the shushioning. But the point is that I think if you're making shorts, we get so many questions for the regular No Film School podcast about what's the future of a short? Yeah. Can I make money with a short? Should I invest time in a short? And I really think the answer is yes. I think that shorts are an absolute pipeline to other things.
Can I caveat that?
Yeah, you could. Yes. Yeah, please contradict me or whatever.
No.
Correct me.
I agree with you.
Shush.
Tell me I'm wrong. Shush me. Yeah.
No, I completely agree with you. But anecdotally, in my experience of people that I know that have had shorts play at Sundance, and directors that I know that have gotten a feature deal off of a short, most of the time, if you make a short, unless it's the concept, what do you call it, a pre-concept, proof of concept for your feature, it's not going to lead to you directing the next feature. I feel like it might get you an agent. It might get you a little bit of buzz, but people are still so conservative about backing a first-time director that, like, I just spoke to the directors of Prospect, which was a short at South By that went viral a long time ago, and they still even had a hard time after doing a very strong viral proof of concept that, you know, won a prize at South By. And then they made, you know, they expanded it into a feature. But people weren't knocking on their door asking them to make just anything. You know, it was very
much. I can speak from experience. That's happened to me. I've had viral shorts that opened doors to agents and managers, and then nothing happened. And the other thing I would say, though, to caveat the caveat, is just that everything is an extremely low percentage. It's not a high percentage play. But I'm not saying like make a short, because then your chances of getting the feature are like above 50%. They're like probably still around 2% or something.
But it's also something that has dramatically changed, and is something I it's good to remind people of, because you will read interviews with directors from the 90s and they will tell, you know, we had this guy come in when I was at USC and he told a story about how he made his thesis short, and then it didn't get into Sundance, but it got into Palm Springs, and this major Hollywood producer saw it and hired him, and within a year of graduating USC he was directing a $4 million movie that he didn't write, just like liked the short directing.
Open directing assignment.
But it was 1995.
Yeah.
It was like
good times.
Like if you go back and watch 90s shorts, like there's just not that many good ones.
Because it was hard to get your hands on the gear to make the project.
Exactly. And so like, and then he showed his short and we were all like, that got you a $4 million. it was flabbergasting. Like I see 20 shorts that good a month now because I'm a, you know. So, like, the world has changed quite dramatically in that respect. And so, like, I would even say when you say a short might get you an agent, like, I think that is I think it might get you meetings with an agent.
Yeah.
But it's still the script, right? It is still, if you have a feature script to follow it up and the feature script is something people are interested in, that is the thing more than anything else. And so, like, honestly, if you made a short that's good enough, but you didn't have a feature script, I would sit on that short until you have a feature script to follow it up with.
Yeah.
Or you, well, Amateur, the Netflix feature currently available on Netflix worldwide, go watch it, would never have happened if I had not made the short Amateur. Yeah. And I did it in a different order. I've been working on the feature script for a long time, but I didn't have something in my director's reel that was of the same tone. So then I wrote a short about the minor characters and went and made that. The funny thing is I posted that on New Film School that I was going to make a short, and there are 250 comments on that, and people are like, this is a bad idea. So I felt vindicated when, you know, Netflix financed the movie. And that short was instrumental not only in getting Netflix to finance it, but getting recognizable actors in the feature, yeah, because they could go watch the short and say, this guy knows how to work with actors. And it's instrumental in getting a state tax credit because they have a list of projects and they can go watch your short and they go, oh, we're going to give it to this one and bump it to the top. I would not be a feature filmmaker if I had not made the decision to make that short. And it is still very difficult to do that. But if you have a 2% chance of getting your feature made after making a short, that's twice as likely as the 1% yeah, chance you had before.
Or the 0%.
But you had the feature script.
I had the feature script.
That's the mistake I think people make. I think shorts are great, yeah, if you have the feature script.
But also I want to note that I didn't do what Whiplash did, where they had a scene from the feature. Yeah. You don't have to take the exact same characters or just a portion of your feature and make it into a short. I felt like the strongest short I could make was sort of a side idea that I'd had after working on this feature for a long time. So make the strongest short you can.
Yeah.
And if it's the same tonally, it has some connection to the feature, that's going to help you. But don't try to make it just a scene from the feature if you don't have a standalone feature. Anyway,
and
to promote our own content, you can go back. We have a 10-hour podcast about the making of Amateur. And there was a whole episode of that about going from a short to a feature.
And actually last year at this very same festival, I interviewed a filmmaker last year who had started with a short through the labs. She ended up getting the feature made. It came and premiered here at Sundance last year. It got bought by Apple and it was distributed.
Was it Hala?
Hala.
Yeah.
Hala. And she told me in the interview that she decided to approach it that way because she listened to the No Film School podcast.
Amazing.
About making. Yeah, it was one of the cool things about, like, we have No Film School graduates out there now making their movies and getting into the festivals, doing the things they learned how to do on, like, that short podcast, that podcast about the making of Amateur and how he used the short. I had a different experience. I made a short that went viral, and then I went and got all those meetings, and then they were like, yeah, go write the feature script. And it was like a, you know, it was a mess. But the point is, I think if you make your short with the idea, like we're saying, of the feature version, and they kind of work in tandem together.
Yeah,
on our podcast, we talked about a piece about the Hustlers sizzle, yeah, and how well that demonstrated her ability to nail the tone for the movie.
Yes.
So there's a lot of examples of that too, where a filmmaker can, I forgot her name.
But Loreen had made movies before.
Yeah. Yes.
A sizzle is different. But one thing I do want to say about the pipeline that Emily was talking about is at the Sundance Lab, first of all, I was rejected from the Sundance Screenwriters Lab like everybody else was. And I think I was rejected 3 years in a row. Then I made a short and then I got in. And you were saying, like, as a writer-director, that's your best chance. And I agree, because at the Screenwriters Lab, we're there as writers. It's not the director's lab. But we do have a screening, and we watch the advisor's material, which is hilarious when one of your advisors is Quentin Tarantino, and he pays to have Inglourious Bastards shipped on 35mm because he refuses to watch it digitally. But we also screen the Fellows material as directors. If you haven't directed anything, what are they going to screen of your own? So I always recommend do a short.
Also, I have to counter my previous argument. My short led to an unrelated feature. Like, my short, I submitted to the producers of the feature, and they hired me off my short to direct the feature. So that does happen. That was 2009. That's not 2019, but, like, a short can lead you places. I also wanted to comment, I remember when I was at Kodak picking up film for my thesis in 2005, I was talking to a person standing next to me at Kodak who was also a USC alum, and she'd been out like 10 years earlier, and she told me something that I still think about 15 years later. She said, you know, when I was in film school, I didn't know anybody getting into Sundance, and now I know almost everybody who gets into Sundance. And it, I think that was truer in 2005 than it is now. I think it's a much bigger palette. But it was sort of an interesting thing that it is a relatively small community. And like even now I look at the Sundance list and I'm able to recognize a lot more people. I might not have met them, but I'm like, I'm aware of the map a lot more in a way I wasn't before.
Let's pour one out for Kodak and for picking a film.
Yes, yeah.
Those were the days.
should we talk about the Shushing?
Can I say an end note for people to listen to the Shorts podcast?
Please, yes, yes.
Oh, also the name of the podcast I did was The First Feature. You might have to use Google to find that, but it's, you know, it's there.
Yeah, check out The First Feature. And as an end note to this conversation on Shorts, we do have listeners. If you're thinking about making a short, and if you're wondering what the Sundance filmmakers did with their shorts this year, we have two really amazing podcasts with short filmmakers this year. And they're at all different stages of their career, and we had some great conversations about why they made a short and what they're doing with it and what they hope to do afterwards. So definitely check out those podcasts.
Those are coming soon. They're not up now, right?
They're not up yet. We just recorded them, so they'll be up hopefully shortly.
So that requires you to subscribe.
Yeah, please subscribe, because all this content with all this information that we're talking about is coming from these roundtables that we're going to be releasing on the podcast. So subscribe to the podcast so you get notified when these come out. There's a lot of great information that comes from people, not from us.
So you guys, I heard something on our text thread, but I don't know what it is, and now it has a name. It's The Shushing. Is this an M. Night Shyamalan movie?
It would be an amazing M. Night Shyamalan movie.
We could call it Shushgate, but that feels a little dated.
I mean, like, should I set it up and then you...
Anything, The Shushing?
Let's just start by saying it happened to me. And I definitely have a tiny bit of PTSD, so nobody tell me to be quiet. Well, I'm telling the story, please.
You've got
Charles, actually, no, you set it up.
Okay, so first off, I think we all have to acknowledge that we're potentially creating career suicide by telling this story, and everybody should know that this is...
That's not that different. No,
the person in question is not listening to this podcast.
He doesn't listen to educational podcasts. So that's fair.
So, and also, it's going to be tricky because we agreed not to talk too much about certain aspects of it. So we went to a party on Friday night. Can we say whose party? Quibi. So we went to the Quibi party. Quibi, if you guys don't know it, you guys are going to hear about it a lot more soon. I'm sure you've heard about it a lot lately. It's a startup by Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman. They've raised $1.5 billion. It just leaked that they've already planned on spending $1.6 billion. So they're already $100 million in the red this year, assuming that subscription revenue will do it. And the interesting thing they are doing is it's a mobile-only content platform. It's only mobile. You cannot watch this content anywhere else. Quibi is short for Quick Bites, and they have this interesting feature called Turnstile, where if you turn your phone from horizontal to vertical, it automatically reframes the content, so it's always full screen. We are not allowed to talk about what we watched, but I will say that Turnstile, for most of the shows, worked really well.
It looked good.
Yeah, I was like really impressed. There was one show where it fell apart when it went to vertical.
Tell us why, though, because I thought that was interesting.
Well, it was just
the difference between that and the way it worked, and I think giving a little insight just into this cool, this emerging thing.
Yeah, this is going to be a big deal. And actually, I have to say, full disclosure: there's a Quibi competitor called Ficto, and I'm doing a show with like the show I did a couple of years ago is going to be on Ficto. So
more plugs.
Yeah, but also maybe I have bias. I don't know. I hope I don't. But oh yeah, that's my baby. So you hold your phone vertically. And then you turn it horizontally, and it automatically reframes. So basically, as a filmmaker, you're making both a 16:9 master and a 9x16 master. And then your phone is auto-detecting and telling exactly which way it's orienting, and it's playing that preview. And also, there's an interesting thing, like Spielberg's doing a Quibi show that apparently you can only watch at night. Like, it uses location data to tell if it's night where you are, because it's a horror show and you're not allowed to watch it when it's daytime, which I think is kind of, like, there's neat stuff about Quibi. There's, like, nerd coolness. And the Quibi party was fascinating. They wouldn't let you put it on your phone. They gave you a phone.
They also wouldn't let me in.
Yes.
That's the first mistake.
It's funny. It's not even that he wasn't on the list. They specifically said, you, George Edelman, we do not want you here.
Yeah.
Everything was really hurtful. Very personal.
No, Oakley believed you.
I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I'm not going to like any of us after this story, maybe.
Well, I mean, I'm saying a lot of nice things. The technology mostly worked. It was clear that some of the filmmakers had put a lot of effort into the 16:9, 9:16 so that as it switched, the framing would be. There were others where I was like, oh, you have this beautiful wide shot. And then when I switch over to 9:16, I'm now framed on this weird character in the corner who's like looking away from camera. And I'm like, I think if you are thinking about doing a show that's like this, I honestly think we should do a tutorial of like how to think about it or something, because like it is different to shoot, I think.
In Premiere Pro, we did a feature on, or an article on, they have a new feature designed for social video and being able to quickly export both versions. I would imagine that the ones that didn't look good were shot before this was going to be their integral feature.
That
and all the
right.
Quibi shows going forward, I assume, will be natively like that.
But it's also like just simple stuff that's like similar to Cinerama, where like I think eyelines are different, right? Like our habits about how we do eyelines and our habits about how we block scenes, I think will change a little bit when you're like, oh, they might be re-cropping in on this.
A two-shot will become a one-shot.
It's exciting, though. It's exciting because it's going to change the way it directs our eye. It's going to open up what filmmakers are doing with that medium. Like, I think it's very cool.
And there was a lot of fun stuff. I mean, we watched a bunch of cool things that we can't talk about, but there were like things that worked.
Okay, I think we've built it up enough.
So we were having a very... I have a loud voice. In college, my nickname was The Shouter. So I want to point out that I was not talking in this moment. I was quietly, peacefully listening, and Emily Booter was not nicknamed The Shouter in college, I don't think. Normal voice volume.
I would say I have a medium voice volume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was having a nice conversation. We're not going to out who it was with because we don't want to burn everyone's career in Hollywood. And we were standing there quietly. You want it?
Yeah. So this party was set up so that there was a screening room where it was basically like a Black Mirror episode. Everyone was just quietly sitting watching their Quibi and being passed hors d'oeuvres with waiters. Amazing hors d'oeuvres, but the waiters were like awkwardly coming up to you being like, I don't want to interrupt your viewing experience, but also here's this thing, you know, drink it and then don't look at anyone while you're watching your thing.
It was actually, not to interrupt, it was kind of beautiful because it was all these faces lit by the blue light of the phone. So it was like this like giant, very fancy room of darkness. It was, with these little points of light.
Then there, right next door, were two open bars and a DJ thing and tons of people rowdily talking. And look, if you want to have a screening party where people just watch your things, don't give us a DJ and two open bars. So I was talking with everybody else. It was a sea of voices.
There
mine
were 100 people talking.
Yes. And then Jeffrey Katzenberg walks up to me, looks me right in the eye, puts his finger over his mouth to make the shushing sound, and then goes, shh.
And what was weird is that it felt for a moment like we've all been at a party where someone's about to give a speech. And for a moment, it felt like he was about, like, oh, a speech is coming. He and Meg Whitman are going to give a speech. So literally, we just stared at him, and we, like, quieted down because we were like, okay. And then he started to walk off, and I was like, okay, he's going to start shushing other people, and now there's going to be some big speech about Quibi and Meg Whitman and everything. But then he just walked off to some other people and started talking, and it gradually dawned on us that he had just shushed Emily Booter for no reason.
He profiled me. I don't know what it was.
What were you talking about?
Nothing having to do with Quibi.
No, actually, yeah.
Well, that's just rude.
Ain't no shushing like a billionaire shushing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Emily, that sucks. You know, in a culture that's telling women every day to shut up, what you're saying is stupid. That's not really what you come to Sundance, a place of championing independent voices. That's not what you have. You know, that's not the experience you're looking for.
Thank you, Oakley.
At a screening party. So.
Yeah, I had not really, like... The gender politics are like not good optics, right? Because if it'd been me, I'm very loud and I'm a dude. So shush me. I've been shushed at parties before, I accept. But like, I get it.
I could see that.
Yeah. Fair. But shushing Emily was like not,
next level.
It's not what Sundance is all about.
So, I mean, I don't know if this is exactly what you're looking for, but I saw Josephine Decker's new film, Shirley, which was incredible. It's not for everybody, but it was definitely for me. And it's about the gothic writer Shirley Jackson, loosely based biopic fair. But if you know anything about Josephine Decker, she is not conventional. So when she was paired with this script, everybody was thinking, you know, how is this going to work out? Is she going to be flattened and constrained by this vision? If you've seen her previous films, she basically only shoots in wide, in a close-up. Everything's very, very shallow. Depth of field. The shots are manic. Editing is manic. The sound design sounds like, you know, you're living in a schizophrenic world. And she applied that to a script that could have been a lot more constrained. And I liked the fact that she brought, she retained her vision and brought it fully to this script that that could have been, you know, it's a weird script, but it could have been done very conventionally. And I liked that she did not compromise one bit. And everyone seems to be liking the film.
Yeah, well, there you go. We've talked a lot about Sundance still being a place where you can be personal and come out guns blazing with your voice and your ideas, and that that's part of what makes a movie a Sundance movie, right? As opposed to what doesn't feel like a Sundance movie or what you might make and still be a great movie but doesn't really belong here. That's the kind of thing that does. So I think we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks, guys, for doing this. It was really hard to schedule this, but we did it. We're all so busy here.
Although I will say, I'll talk about this in the Colors podcast.